Is there any matter of housekeeping or anything that any party wants to raise now? Mr. Conway.
Good morning, Your Honour. Yesterday you noted there was an issue with your copy of Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence and that there was some of the diagrams.
My copy at least had, yes.
Missing. We have replacement hard copies here.
Cool.
caught in any parties who's having that same issue. So we'll also endeavour to get in, say, the electronic version through with the pagination in it, so that that could be replaced in the electronic bundle for anyone who needs that. Find that vendor, I understand, so that should be in the inboxes of the hearing manager and the parties now, as that assists on the way through.
Thank you very much. Anything else? Anyone else have anything?
Very good.
All right. Let me just check. Mr. Matheson, any issue if I just get the witness to acknowledge his previous oath? Any other issue for anyone if I just get the witness to acknowledge?
Dr. Scarsbrook, do you recall the oath that we made yesterday in terms of telling the truth?
Excuse me, sir. I'm not sure if you can hear me,
yes.
But the audio hasn't been turned on in the courtroom yet, so we can't hear you online. I'm not sure if you can hear us, though.
Just give me a moment.
Now we can. Thank you.
Very good. All right. I was just confirming with the witness that he recalled the oath that he made yesterday to tell the truth. He has told me that he does recall that, and on that basis he does not need to be re-sworn. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Matheson.
Thank you. Good morning, Dr. Scarsbrook. Hope you had a relaxing night, not worrying about the evidence, but that you read the McDowell paper again before you went to bed. I've just got one question for you on that, if you've got a copy there. And it relates to page 1044 of the paper. Do you have a copy in front of you?
I haven't got a paper. I had it on my iPad. But
Do you have a copy still with you or not?
I don't, no.
Gave away my spare copy.
That's
all right.
Very helpful, thank you.
Oh, is it? It is in the secondary bundle register. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
I'll just let you get to it. So it's page 144. So this is the discussion section.
Yes.
And just to help me, so the Strala stream water system, so order one is tributaries, is that right?
So yes,
the smallest stream?
The smallest stream is order one.
Yep, and then we move down 2, 3, and order two is with two ones.
That's correct.
Yep, yes. And yep, 2, 2, 3, etc. Yep.
And then very large rivers like the Waikato would be a 7 or 8.
Yep, so the Waikato I think is a 7, and I think the Waipa's a 6. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Yes.
So, and then in the main discussion, on page 144, it starts off on the second, the last full paragraph of page 144. It starts, for all other contaminants, the main pathway of loss is runoff, combination of surface and subsurface flow. And then if you look down a sentence after the next one, in theory, runoff contaminant yield should be greater in smaller streams with a greater proportion of flow as surface runoff than larger streams. But then the paper goes on to say that that's actually not what was found in the paper. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
So actually what they found was the greater the stream order, i.e. further down the catchment, the more intensive the land use and the greater the contaminants per hectare. That's what the paper ended up finding.
Yes, that tend to be the case in terms of nitrogen lost through leaching. They make the point here that higher up in the catchment with different topography, that you are likely to be generating more sediment per hectare than nitrogen.
But still, even with sediment per hectare, the paper found that even the sediment runoff per hectare increased with the intensity of land use, didn't it?
Yes.
So the greater, the flatter the land, the more intensive the land use, the greater the sediment loss.
In general, yeah, the flavour of the land, and obviously it depends on soil types as well, but the capability of the land is greater.
Yeah. Correct. Thank you. I'm done with that, so, Commissioner, if you need your pay with that, but otherwise we can move to another topic. and that's your rebuttal evidence, paragraph 82. I'll just need to get that.
In relation to ECOR?
No, or up to wetland, so rebuttal evidence.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Council's position is that all stock should be excluded from any wetland of more than 50 square metres, is that right? And you support that from a water quality perspective?
Yes.
So that's 7.2 metres by 7.2 metres?
Roughly, yes.
So every wetland on all the 2,000 farms in the Waikato would have to fence wetlands as small as 7 metres by 7 metres.
That's my understanding of the policy, yes.
Sorry, what policy? Of the rules in the PC1.
Yes, sorry. Yes.
Yeah. And the stock exclusion regulations only require stock to be excluded from wetlands of less than 500 square metres, don't they?
That's my understanding, yes.
Do you know how many thousands of wetlands there would be on the farms across Waikato greater than 7 metres by 7 metres?
Our initial mapping would suggest that there's probably 10,000 or more wetlands of the size required by the MPSFM mapping, which is 500 square metres. So it's likely that smaller wetlands would be even more numerous.
Okay, so there's 10,000 big wetlands.
About tens of thousands.
So we're into tens of thousands of wetlands on farms that would need to be fenced.
Yes.
As small as 7.5 metres by 7.5 metres.
Yes.
And the rule that you support would be irrespective of any of the values of that wetland at all, just if it's a natural wetland.
Yes, all wetlands play an important role in the landscape. Terms of trapping sediments and also processing contaminants, and stock access to those wetlands can create significant disturbance of those wetlands. So from a technical perspective, it is beneficial to exclude stock from wetlands.
Can I ask you, you said yesterday I think that you hadn't read Mr. Cameron's evidence. Did you read Mr. Berry's evidence?
No.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to go to Mr. Berry's evidence because he addresses this particular issue. So it's tab 13 of folder 304. If we can start at page 230, sorry, paragraph 237, which is on page 76. So have you got page 76?
Yes, there's a photograph.
Yeah. So there's an intermittent swamp on Pukatik Tree that's not fenced, but stock access is managed through troughs and a grazing management plan. And then over the page, above 238, there's a wetland there that's about 4,000 or so square metres. And you see he's marked in red where he would need to fence. And that's obviously well bigger than 500 square metres and well bigger than 50 square metres. But he's noted there that at the moment he manages stock access to that through grazing practices. And he also notes here that the cost of a 614 metre fence around that wetland would be about $12,500, or nearly $12,500. Do you understand, or if you go over to paragraphs 240 to 243, he talks about the particular practical difficulties of fencing around wetlands. I understand you have a dairy background, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
So you would understand that cattle tend to track around fence lines, don't they?
To some extent, less so than deer, but yes, to some extent.
And one of the concerns Mr. Berry has is at paragraph 242, is if all these small wetlands were fenced, cattle would track around them, and that would generate sediment, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Which would affect the wetland?
If the flow path went into the wetland, yes.
So that's an additional source of sediment that wouldn't be there if the fence wasn't there?
Not sure if it's additional. So it's what you're saying is it's additional to the situation where stock wouldn't have access and there wasn't fence line pacing. But one of the primary reasons to exclude stock from wetlands is to stop the damage of the soils around the wetland itself, which would also be a major source of sediment.
Yeah, and Mr. Berry's concern is if you put a fence up, cattle will track around it and generate more sediment. Mr. Berry manages his stock through the wetland, through grazing practices, water crops and other locations in order to keep them out of the wetland.
Right.
Are you familiar or are you aware that the stock exclusion regulations already require a number of different types of wetlands below 500 square metres to be fenced?
Yes, particularly those that contain threatened species.
So that's already a requirement of the stock regulations?
That's my understanding.
And you understand my clients are not challenging that requirement?
I wasn't aware of that.
So my client's position is 500 square metres plus every other requirement of the National Environment, of the stock exclusion regulations, whatever the size. So you would accept, and then the stock exclusion regulations also require wetlands to be fenced of any size if it's listed in the regional plan, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I know about the threatened species one for sure, but yeah, that sounds.
So the wetlands with the greatest values are already protected under the stock exclusion regulations, irrespective of what we do.
So that's the intent of those regulations. So having that, those wetlands that contain threatened species, i.e., higher values, would be protected as well. That's my understanding.
So, just lastly, say we've got a 50 square metre wetland, and we've got tens of thousands of these small wetlands. On a 50 square metre wetland, if my maths is correct, and it may not be, if you have a 10 metre setback around a 50 square metre wetland, you end up fencing off something like 600 to 700 square metres of land. Almost 10 times the size of the wetland is fenced off and lost for production.
That would be the implication, yes.
And when it's fenced off, you're aware from your cattle background, I'm sure, that sheep are naturally woolly insulated. They tend to push through electric wires. They push over the poles. Electric wires are not a very good impediment to sheep getting through. Do you have any experience in sheep or not?
No.
No. So they're quite effective if cattle and horses, they don't stock sheep. So amidst the various cases he mentioned in his evidence, he runs both sheep and cattle on the high country at different times of the year, in different places, in response to climate, conditions, grass growth, etc., which is a sensible farming management approach. All of these wetlands, all of the small wetlands on the dry stock farms would need to be fenced with post and batten fences because they have sheep in the paddocks. At a cost of $20 a metre, around all of those tens of thousands of wetlands, and you'll be also that the inside the wetland would need to be subject to weed control.
From a management perspective, yes, I'm not sure if there's any regulatory requirements for weed control.
But a good farmer would want to get in there and control the weeds before they spread.
Yes.
So they need to go over the fence into all of these tens of thousands of wetlands that are fenced off and undertake weed control.
Yes, that would be great.
Good. Are you aware that there's nothing in the stock excluding regulations, the National Environmental Standards on Freshwater, or the NPCFM that prevents stock grazing in wetlands?
Other than requirements for stock exclusion?
Yeah, but small wetlands, there's no requirement. And I raise this because you mentioned your evidence about the end of your paragraph 82, the NES restricts activities within specified setbacks from all natural wetlands. So were you aware that those provisions do not control or restrict grazing of animals in wetlands?
So the definition of natural wetlands has both that size component to it and also the element of the threatened species. So the natural wetlands, as per the definition and the regulations, require stock exclusion. But if wetlands that occur that don't fit that definition, then it would follow that those regulations don't require stock exclusion.
And disturbance in a wetland, the controls on disturbing a natural wetland don't include grazing of animals, do they? Or do you not know? If you don't know, that's fine. I won't take it.
Well, yeah, so if by the regulation stock are allowed access to wetlands, then yes, that would follow.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Scott. Thanks. Yeah.
Who is expecting to go next? I have lost the list.
I think it's why I could ask for soon.
Right, thank you very much. Ms. Carruthers, are you happy to go next?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Dr. Scarsbrook. Can you hear me all right this morning?
Yeah, very well. Thank you.
Okay, great. I just have a couple of clarification questions, actually, if I could, please, relating to your rebuttal evidence.
Yes.
So at paragraph 7 of that, you identify the evidence that you're responding to in your rebuttal. As you may have heard the judge just mention, I act for Wairaki Pastoral Limited, and I can't see my client's witnesses listed in your paragraph 7. But if we turn over to your paragraph 87, which appears under the heading Degradation of Water Quality, you note there that you have been asked by Mr. Trevalco to address evidence on behalf of other parties proposing a less restrictive activity status for land use conversions of the type regulated by Rule 311.49. Is that a reference to Wairaki Pastoral Limited and other parties?
Not specifically, but more generally. So I'd say there that a lack of controls on land use intensification was likely causes of degradation or deterioration.
I'll get on to that, sorry. My question was more in relation to the scope of whose appeals and what evidence you're responding to in paragraph 87. So my question was whether this is a response to the Wairaki Pastoral Limited evidence, despite them not being listed in your paragraph 7.
Yeah, no, it wasn't in relation to anyone's specific evidence. It was a general comment about intensification.
I see. And so it was a general comment that you made when asked to do so by Mr. Trebalco?
Yes.
Okay. And so where you mentioned there parties proposing a less restrictive activity status, the question of the appropriate activity status, that is for the planners to comment on, and you're providing the technical information and support, is that correct?
So Mr. Trebalco had asked me to address evidence on behalf of other parties, plural, proposing less restrictive activity status, and I guess my response was reasonably general rather than specific.
I see. But your response is in relation to what your concerns are rather than the appropriate activity status.
From a technical perspective, my concerns in relation to land use intensification.
Okay, great. And so if we go to that then, on the first line of the next page, you talk about conversions of forest pasture. And I wanted to check, was that supposed to be from forest to pasture, or is the context I'm not familiar with?
No,
right,
that's correct. That's an error, conversion of forest to pasture.
To pasture, okay. And as I understand it from this paragraph, your concern is that when that conversion is uncontrolled and it needs to be appropriately controlled.
Yeah, that's my opinion. I'm just wondering, is it worth giving context of where PC1 or some of the original drivers of PC1?
No, that's fine. No, I'm just checking that your evidence is that the conversion needs to be appropriately controlled.
Yes.
Right. And so then at paragraph 88, you identify conversion of pine to dairy as your primary concern. Is that correct?
Yes, so that's in relation to a study Waikato Regional Council has undertaken on land use intensification as part of our state environment report. So there it was in relation to what would an example of major intensification be? And in this case, I used pine to dairy conversion as an example of major intensification.
Right.
As defined in that technical report.
Okay, thank you. And as I understand it, that is because of the potential contaminant losses from that new land use. Is that correct?
Yes. So in general, land use intensification without appropriate mitigations will lead to increases in contaminant loss to water.
And the discharges that follow that conversion.
Yeah, so discharges from land to water, yes.
Right. And so if we drill down then, is it the discharges that you're seeking to control?
So, yes, controls on the possible effects of the land use intensification, i.e. via...
Please keep going.
Oh.
It'll just be the
camera. Oh, okay.
Continue your evidence.
So you
can hear us, Ms. Carruthers?
Sorry. I'm back.
All right.
Sorry, but I didn't hear the answer.
No, he paused, and I wasn't certain whether the audio was still going, but now I probably should check each time.
Yeah.
So,
no, it was actually the whole video disappeared,
yes,
not just
audio. I understand. I understand.
Okay.
Please continue, Dr. Scott.
The comment is about looking to control the potential effects of land use intensification, which would most likely be in relation to discharges of contaminants of land to water.
That's all I have, thank you, sir. I think with the... So will the transcript pick up the rest of the answer from when I was kicked out, do you know?
The witness stopped immediately when you went off screen.
Oh, okay.
So I don't think anything... And then he and I had a brief conversation about whether he should continue, because I thought the audio might continue, but you have corrected me and shown that that was incorrect. I don't think you've missed anything.
Okay, thank you.
In any event, if I can just check, Mr. Hudson, you've got everything that's happened in this room, haven't you?
Correct, sir.
Yeah, we are using the speech-to-text trialing system that the Ministry of Justice is working on. We have Mr. Hudson here, and he is assuring me that everything that is happening in this room is being recorded through his system, even if it's not being picked up through VMR. I hope that reassures you.
No, absolutely. I have finished my questions of Dr. Scarsbrook, thank you. But while we're discussing tech, the camera that swings around to the witness is otherwise on the bench, which means that when we're asking questions remotely, we can see the witness, but also the lawyers at their tables, not the bench at the same time. I'm not sure if there's a way to change that at all. Not that I mind watching Mr. Matheson and Ms. Edwards and Ms. Chappell and others all in the room. But if there is a way to if there's a way to see both the bench and the witness at the same time, that would be super helpful from my perspective.
Right.
Not a problem if not.
You'll just have four poker faces up here. But Madam Registrar, is there any way that the two cameras, we used to have a whole lot more cameras, but they were taken out over the weekend and they did various other things.
I'm afraid the witness and the bench share a camera, so
yeah.
No, sir.
I'm sorry about that.
No, that's fine. I thought it was worth asking, but that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Now we come to fish and game. Ms. Omni.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, if we could pass, Mr. Matheson, if that... There may be a connection that needs to be shifted. Mr. Hudson, can you assist?
Yeah, it's a hard one, isn't it? High tech and part low tech, I think.
Good morning, Mr. Scarsbrook.
Good morning.
Firstly, I'd like to ask you some questions along the lines that I asked Mr. McAuliffe yesterday about the Table 311.1 in PC1 and the extent that that might need to be altered in the freshwater plan review. And it would help if you have in front of you the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management, which is...
I don't have it in paper form, is it in there?
It should be in one of the... I think it's in the volume 501, either part 1 or part 2.
I have the page number, but not the tab number.
The volume, the first volume of that tab 5.
Tab 5, is it the 501?
Thank you.
There we are.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And my questions are around policy 3.13, which is on page, the court's page numbering system 501.0090. And as you'll no doubt aware, Mr. Scarsbrook, this policy revolves around target attribute setting for nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus. And is it your understanding that this policy, the content of this policy, except for sub 5, was included in the 2014 version of the NPSFN as it was amended in 2017 as a note under the periphyton attribute stage?
Yes, I'm aware that largely in relation to periphyton, yes.
So this isn't entirely new in the 2020 version, is it?
The concept of nutrient exceedance criteria is quite new and is quite a substantial change.
Thank you. The other substantial change, as I just flagged before, is sub 5, which sets out examples of the different attributes that may be affected by nutrients and provides a list there.
Yes.
And I understand you're undertaking work with the use of Dr. Snelder to understand further the relationship between nutrients and these other attributes here, which includes macroinvertebrates.
Yes, that's correct.
So, in the freshwater plan review, you will be looking at setting short-term states for the tributaries and the subcatchments, because as I said yesterday, my understanding is that they're currently only for nitrogen toxicity and DRP for current state.
That's correct, yes. And there are total nitrogen and total phosphorus targets set for the main stem of the Waikato River.
And even for the tributaries, Dr. O'Say, given the evidence, has pointed out that the targets for the tributaries at the moment don't add up to what's required in the main stem. They've been set on a tributary-by-tributary basis, so the maths, if you like, hasn't been undertaken to see whether they would all add up to what you need to achieve in the main stem.
That's right, and that's due to the way that the targets were set by the collaborative stakeholder group. So they set targets for each individual subcatchment, including the subcatchment nodes along the main stem of the river. So you're correct, there was no attempt made at trying to do the maths to make it all add up at that stage.
Yes, and that was to do with the fact that it was around economic issues, wasn't it, that there should be a 20% change from current state to a state that you needed to achieve in a tributary, on a tributary by tributary basis?
So the
very, very simple terms, the collaborative stakeholder group's approach was to set 80-year targets that involved either maintaining where that water quality was already considered good, or moving up a band. So if it was in the C band and that was considered degraded, then it would be moved up a band to band B. And so then the current state is obviously what it's like now. The 80-year target was that improvement or maintaining, and then the 20% is the 20% of the gap between the current and the 80-year target.
I see. Thank you for that. So even with regards to the adding up all the 80-year targets to achieve the total nitrogen and total phosphorus targets in the main stem, even the total nitrogen and total phosphorus targets in the main stem may need to be altered in the freshwater policy review process.
Yes. Going back to mediation, I had some conversations with Department of Conservation and Fish and Game technical experts, and at that time my view was that we could leave the TN and TP targets in the river as they are. I think following the expert caucusing, I think we all agreed that, particularly in the lower river, the impacts of particularly Lake Whangapae and Lake Waikare discharges into the river have significant impacts. And so, yes, I can see the need for some revision of those numbers, particularly if we set more stringent targets for those lakes.
Thank you. Well, that draws into the lakes issue well. For lakes, the current attribute states are a narrative state of maintain for the 10-year point, and for the 80-year point, you've set attribute states for lakes at the NPSFM bottom line.
Yeah, the CSG set those targets, yes.
And those are clearly placeholders.
Yes, I think they were always considered as placeholders.
And the setting of targets for lakes will affect upstream catchments because under 3.13 of the NPSFM 2, number subparagraph 2, whether a nutrient-sensitive downstream receiving environment the in-stream concentrations and exceedance criteria or in-stream loads for NNP must be set so as to achieve the environmental outcomes sought for the nutrient sense of downstream receiving environment.
Yes.
And you have said in your evidence and in the joint witness conference saying that, I think it's just in the JWS that you'll develop developing nutrient limits for lakes based on the Wollenweide model for the 21 lakes that you're able to do that, and there's a draft report on that.
Yes, so initial work was done on 21 lakes, and we're in the process of contracting a complete assessment of all 38 lakes in our lakes monitoring program, so that's getting underway now. The initial work done on 21 lakes is a draft paper that will be hopefully quite soon submitted to publication in an international journal.
Thank you. And just to orientate ourselves, there are 59 shallow lakes. Is it over a certain size within the PC1 area?
Yeah, over 1 hectare within the PC1 area.
Right. Thank you. So I'll move into some more questions about attributes shortly, but I just wanted to talk to you about the role of yourself as a technical expert. So, as a technical expert, you can advise on the attributes that reflect the vision and the values, and that's obviously guided by the NPSFM and the state of attributes in the NPSFM. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that's reasonable.
And you can also advise on some of the values. And to give an example, for late, the decision under appeal at paragraph 118 said the peat lakes within the catchment are valued for their unique genetic diversity, scientific interest. And so you can advise on those sorts of issues.
Yes, so we will have a range of information that we can help people understand what, how they might quantify the values that they have.
And the peat lakes are a valuable habitat for many unique animals and plants, but then it goes on to say that they're under threat.
Yes.
Or you can also advise on trends and what's occurring in the environment so as to give the court some understanding of the sense of urgency with various issues.
Yes.
And you can also advise on your extensive knowledge as to causes and how to whether you know how to control the various attribute states.
That's fair.
In terms of costs and benefits, though, you would agree, wouldn't you, that apart from perhaps the costs of monitoring, that matter is not within your purview?
Certainly, yeah, I'd agree, not within the purview of freshwater science technical experts.
Thank you. So I'd like to move to the attribute state of dissolved oxygen. And the Director General of Conservation is seeking that be included as both an interim and a long-term attribute state, an interim attribute state for the lower Waikato FMU. And in terms of the urgency around that, you've discussed yesterday the anoxic events in the Whangarino wetland. And you've also said in the JWS freshwater that you know generally that the actions required in PC1 will are consistent with approving dissolved oxygen.
In that reductions in nutrients achieved through the methods in PC1 may reduce the growth of plants and algae, which would then have an effect on dissolved oxygen.
I'll ask you to turn to the joint witness statement, freshwater, please.
Question number?
401.0001 is the commencement of that statement. And if we can turn to number 10, which is on 401.009.
Yep, so how can low oxygen in rivers impact lakes and wetlands?
Yes. So, in that question, you've outlined that the anoxic events of the scale, duration and severity of those seen in Juan Marino are symptomatic of a severely degraded water quality. And in the item above that, number one, you've explained the relationship between the lower oxygen in rivers and the low oxygen found in the wetland. Now, if we go down to 11, this talks about whether there is an urgency in providing for a CO target attribute state. And at your at the JWS number 3, it stated there's uncertainty around the attribute's applicability to lowland sites which may be naturally lower in DO. And we recommend DO to be implemented as a monitoring requirement with the bottom line set as a trigger value for management intervention. Can you explain what you mean by that?
So in point 3, in lowland waterways, they are often dominated by aquatic plants. And even in natural systems, those systems aren't impacted by humans, you will see a natural diurnal pattern of dissolved oxygen as the plants obviously produce oxygen through photosynthesis during the daytime and then respire and use up oxygen during the nighttime. So what we're uncertain about at this stage is to what extent naturally occurring systems in the Waikato may not meet the national bottom lines in the NPSF in 2020. So there's an unknown there about to what extent they might fall under that category in the policy statement around allowing for natural variability or variability in natural systems. So that's an unknown at the moment. So that relates to point 3. In terms of point 4, and I think specific to some of the issues that I talked about yesterday around Whangarino, is we are implementing this summer more widespread dissolved oxygen monitoring, which has been, I think, reasonably ad hoc in the past, but we're putting in place monitoring of a number of parts of the region because of issues such as Whangarino. And we are looking to set those trigger points for action relating to dissolved oxygen, as I talked about yesterday.
When do you think you may be up in a position to do that?
So last week we presented to the Whangarino Response Plan Working Group, which includes Department of Conservation staff, Fish and Game staff, Mana Whenua, Waikato River Authority, Waikato Tainui and others, and presented a draft dashboard for those trigger values, and everyone seemed reasonably happy with those trigger values that we were proposing. It is likely that we would look to revise those trigger values following more monitoring this summer.
Thank you. So if we return to number 3, there's uncertainty around the attributes of applicability to lowland sites which may be naturally lower in DO. If you had an attribute state, could you have a narrative that said something like unless found in natural conditions?
Yes.
You could deal with that issue like that?
They could be dealt with it like that, yes.
And then if we go to question 12 of the JWS at page 40111, number 3, you state whilst that actions require, or the witnesses state whilst actions required by PC1 are generally consistent with DO improvements, there is a significant uncertainty about the level of timing of improvements in DO that may be achieved by PC1, as these have not been assessed or modelled, and on that basis you're uncertain whether there should or could be short or long-term attribute states. But that gets into the question for the planners about the level of certainty that's required in order to achieve these things before you put them in the plan, doesn't it?
Yes, so in relation to the freshwater policy review, dissolved oxygen is one of the attributes where we want to, we see that as a really high priority in terms of providing dissolved oxygen attributes and current state and target states and through that freshwater policy review. I think we're still in that process of bringing together the information, both modelled and measured information, to be able to do that. So yes, we're uncertain at this time as to exactly what that dissolved oxygen, or where we would focus our dissolved oxygen attribute in different parts of the region. Notwithstanding what I talked about yesterday, is we've undertaken some analysis of where the most high risk areas are.
Thank you. I'll move to Lakes now. I want to just briefly talk about lake trends. In your evidence, you talk about the last State of the Environment report on lakes, and this is also covered by Fish and Game's witness, David Klee, at paragraphs 9.7 and 9.8 of his evidence. Now, you don't need to turn to that. I'll give the page reference. It's 3119.0170. But both you and Mr. Klee state that the long-term trend analysis 2003 to 2022 at all 12 sites where long-term monitoring data is available shows a general ongoing degradation in water quality from baseline state. That's also your understanding?
That's correct. There is another statement made there about short-term improvements.
Yes. So over short-term timescales, 3 to 5 years, 6 of the 12 lakes show some improvements in trophic lake index. However, this may be largely attributed to climatic drivers, namely reduced nutrient and sediment loading due to the lower than average rainfall over that period.
I think that's a reasonable hypothesis that it's climate driven, yes. But we haven't been able to identify the cause of that more recent improvement.
Mm. The other hypothesis he gives us at 9.8 is that improvements witnessed in chlorophyll A levels in some of the lakes may be a residual effect of decreasing water quality with increased light limitation rather than improvement in water quality.
Yep, that's another reasonable hypothesis. But as I say, we haven't done the analysis to try and determine the causes.
So, you would agree, would you, that the longer-term analysis, which I think is a 10-year period, or approximately 10-year period, rather than the short-term timescales of 3 to 5 years, shows us more because it's noise out the climatic driver issue?
Yes, although there are longer-term climate cycles, interdecadal climate cycles, that can sometimes affect those trends as well. So what we tend to look at when we look at trends in water quality, we tend to look at, based on other sources of knowledge, you know, is it consistent with, so are the deteriorating trends, for example, consistent with information about land use acceptation, as an example. So for a lot of the deteriorating trends that we've seen in the region in terms of water quality, it is consistent with the assessments of land use intensification that we've seen. But we don't have that cause-effect link locked down.
Thank you. So you agree that generally, as a general proposition, we're seeing a degradation in lakes and looking at a multiple lines of evidence approach that is consistent with intensification of land use that may be creating contaminant inputs into lakes.
Yes, that's reasonable.
we can go to the JWS Lakes point. I'm calling it that, but it's day two of the Wetland and Lakes conference thing, and it's at 401037.
Which question number, please?
If you can go to number 9, which is on page 401042. And I want to talk to you about the risk of not having attribute states set for lakes in terms of signals to landowners in those lake catchments about what is ultimately going to be required on, for them to achieve ecosystem health and lakes. And in the second bullet point there under 9, you talk about the benefits of an approach of pegging nutrient loads using the Vollenweider modelling, which explicitly aims to quantify current and target nutrient loads required to achieve water quality targets. And you say the benefit is that it gives everyone some certainty of what the goalposts are. And it also provides landowners with realistic expectations about what they are required to achieve. So, you've agreed, haven't you, that the scale of the issue with regards to lakes is significant?
Yes.
And so there's a risk with the farm environment planning consents given to farmers in lake catchments that it's not going to achieve what's required in lakes.
The initial work that we've done, so that's still in draft for the freshwater policy review, indicates that for many of those lake catchments, we're talking about very significant reductions in the loads of nitrogen and phosphorus that are going to be required simply to get those lakes to the national bottom line for TN and TP. In many situations, those load reductions are likely to require significant land use change and de-intensification within those lake catchments. So that, in terms of providing clarity to the landowners, I absolutely agree. I think that modelling work that is being undertaken will be really important in setting limits on resource use to try and improve those lakes.
Thank you. It's not only achieving NPSFM bottom lines, is it? My understanding is it's also just maintaining the state of lakes at their current state.
Yes, because lakes tend to act as a sink for sediment and nutrients. They have quite a significant internal load of nutrients. So many of these shallow lakes are constantly being either through wind or the actions of things like koi carp, sediment resuspended, nutrient resuspension, and so that internal load will continue to fuel degradation until the external loads have been reduced to a point where the whole system can flush itself out.
And do you, I understand that some of these lakes, because of that cycling process, you will never be able to get them back to the state that they were in. And in that respect, the changes caused by the nutrients are irreversible.
With current science and current approaches, I think yes, that we have to be realistic that some of these lakes
could not be returned to perhaps a more stable macrophyte dominated or aquatic plant dominated state. They'll stay in that more unstable phytoplankton or algal dominated state. In terms of being optimistic, I think over time it is likely that we can come up with restoration or rehabilitation actions that will help us return fast. And there are examples overseas of lakes being restored or rehabilitated from a very degraded state, but they tend to be extremely costly exercises.
And I think I've said that we need to analyse this on a lake-by-lake basis. We can't make general statements across all the lakes because each lake is different in terms of what may be required, and it relates quite highly to the size of the lake, for example.
Yes, to a certain extent, each lake will have its specific issues and the local context of the lake. So in that respect, management of that lake will need to take that into account. In a more general sense, we use different lake types, so peat lake, riverine lake, as a management tool for sort of identifying this is how we're going to manage peat lakes, this is how we might be looking to manage riverine lakes, etc.
I'll get into the management using those four categories shortly, but just to finish off on that particular line of questioning, even if you don't, in a particular lake-by-lake approach, or for particular lakes, say that we want to achieve what was there before, it is quite realistic, isn't it, for lakes to go up a level in the band system using what may be our land use changes approach in the catchments?
Yes, if we can significantly reduce external nutrient loads, so the loads getting into lakes from the catchment, over time we would expect to see an improvement, and that might be enough to lift it up a band. We have seen a couple of instances where significant reductions or significant programs of work have resulted in quite significant improving trends in small lakes. There's a lake, Waifokoriki, which is on the outskirts of Hamilton City, and it's undergone a significant change of land use in its catchment. And as largely as a result of that and other management interventions, the trophic lake index has improved significantly.
What was the change in land use?
So it went primarily from pasture to back into native forest. There was also a small area of urban land use in that catchment as well. So there's been wetlands and things installed.
One final question. Do you take the tea break at
10? Well, I will take it slightly early. I was thinking we'd rather than 11:30, we'd take it at 11.
Oh, I'll keep going in there.
If you would. unless you're done.
No. just one final question before we move on to another topic. Changing the land use. I've noted here that it could include things such as reducing stocking rates. I'll list them all, actually.
Where are you referring to?
Well, this is just my notes.
Oh.
reducing stocking rates, retiring land, planting indigenous vegetation, and restoring or creating wetlands could be some of the tools that you might use. Thank you. Now I wish to turn to wetlands before going to the topic of freshwater management units or FMUs. for wetlands, fish and game is seeking to be added to Table 311.1, narrative states for wetland values. And those are based on the evidence of Dr. Hugh Robertson, who's given evidence to the Director General of Conservation. And if I can ask you to pull up this evidence, I think it's volume 320, tab 4.
Ms. Kissick at tab 4.
Oh, sorry. Tab 7, sorry. Can't read my own writing. Now, before we get into that, from a technical perspective, what is your view on, and I'll get into the detail shortly, on putting wetland narrative states in Table 311.1 of PC1.
So I think, in my view, narrative states are allowed for under the NPS and previous versions of the NPS. In my view, the proposed narrative attribute state that Dr. Robertson is proposing is, in my view, not actually a narrative, because it uses the term healthy range so that the contaminants are in what he terms a healthy range. So that is essentially identifying the range of numbers for a contaminant that would be considered healthy. So that is directly equivalent to numeric attributes that are already in the NPSFM. So while it's termed a narrative, it's essentially, in my view, an undefined numeric attribute, because the range of numbers that would be used are not defined.
What attributes in the NPSFM are you talking about?
So the attributes in Appendix 2A and 2B of the NPSFM use the A, B, C, D bands, and for each of those bands there's a range of numbers. So those ranges are used to define the bands. And one of those bands would be identified as the desired target state, and you would also have a current state. So those are numeric attributes, so based on ranges of numbers. What Dr. Robertson is suggesting is an attribute for wetlands which would also use a range of numbers to define what good condition is, but that range of numbers isn't defined. So that's why I'm saying, in my view, that's an undefined numeric attribute. It's not a narrative attribute.
Because the Freshwater Policy Review has not been put in place yet with the numeric attributes, what is the problem with putting a narrative in PC1 that's, again, effectively a placeholder until you put the numeric attributes in?
Yeah, from a technical perspective, I guess in the technical course thing, my fundamental issue is around having something undefined from a technical sense. So Dr. Robertson hasn't actually provided the information on how you would define that range that he suggested in the narrative, in the narrative attribute. So I think what was covered in the technical coursing though was some proposed approaches that we could take, and Dr. Robertson helpfully provided some references to information we could use to then build numeric attributes for wetlands through the Freshwater Policy Review.
In paragraph 142 and 143 of his evidence, he talks about guidance to define a healthy range as achievable for wetlands in PC1, and there's national wetland data, for example, on wetland soil nutrient status and wetland condition parts in 2015, so that would be the sort of thing you'd look at.
Yes.
And in the meantime, if these narrative states aren't included in PC1, isn't there a danger that with the farm environment plans and the consenting, the knowledge that wetlands do need to be managed in terms of nutrients and are not just to be treated as a nutrient sink, needs to be clearly communicated?
So the absence, and the absence of having attributes in place, in my opinion, you would look at what changes are going to happen in the catchment, and there's an expectation that changes in behaviour on farm and in other areas is going to lead to a reduction in nutrient loss from the land to water. So those ecosystems, including wetlands and groundwater systems are another example. So the benefits that accrue to freshwater habitats and can be measured through those places we have monitoring in surface water, we expect to see improvements in contaminant levels as a result of PC1. Those same benefits would accrue to wetlands and other unmonitored habitats as well.
Yes, but currently on a relatively undefined basis, and I understand, yes, on a relatively undefined basis as to what it might achieve.
Yes, so there's a range of methods whereby we're looking to protect wetlands, and that will be also in relation to the levels of contaminant loss from the land, but also direct effects on stock access and things like that.
Yes, no, I think you've also said in the witness conference thing that you intend to convey the current state of knowledge of the Waikato Regional Council on this matter, and you can please help me with this acronym, it's the CCV, or the information that
yes.
You give to farmers for the farm environment plans.
Yeah, so that stands for the Catchment Context Challenges and Values. So this is a package of information that regional councils are required to provide landowners to assist them with their freshwater farm plans.
So just finally, if you have a placeholder for a state in Table 3, 11.1 for wetlands, it will provide a red flag that in that CCCV, you need to be providing that information to farmers within wetland catchments.
It could do. I'm just not sure what additional benefit it has in comparison to all the other ways we would achieve that.
Thank you. That's perhaps more a planning question then. Now, with regards to freshwater management units, Fish and Game is seeking a freshwater management unit for the Whangamorino wetland and are seeking a different categorisation for the EPUs for lakes, which is currently the four categories, peat, riverine, volcanic and dune. In the wetland JWS at 7, I'll just, you don't need to turn to it, but I'll just turn to it myself, or if you want, you can. bullet point 2, the experts have stated from a purely technical perspective, Whangamorino wetland having its own EPU would be appropriate for freshwater management and accounting purposes. So from a technical perspective, you would support a separate EPU for the Whangamorino?
So I think that view is consistent with what was in the decisions version. I think where the view is that we could set Whangamorino wetland as a separate FMU. There's a, and I mentioned or talked in the expert caucus thing that if it was set as an FMU, one of the benefits might be make it easier to argue for resources to fill some of the monitoring gaps that we have in the Whangamorino and Lake Waikare catchments. So from a purely technical perspective, yes, I think you could set Whangamorino wetland as an EPU.
Given the outstanding nature of the Whangamorino, both nationally and internationally, from that perspective, achieving more holistic monitoring across that wetland complex would be a very good reason for having a Whangamorino as a separate EPU, wouldn't it?
In my view, and if I may, in Plan Change 1, the freshwater management units are less important than the targets that are set, particularly for individual sub-catchments. As I say, apart from perhaps making arguments or strengthening the argument for better resourcing of monitoring, I'm not sure that having Whangamorino as an FMU would greatly assist its management. I think there is, as we talked about yesterday, there are some major issues with Whangamorino and Lake Waikare, and all of the agencies involved or that have statutory responsibilities or ethical responsibilities, if you like, for managing that area, are coming together to develop both short-term and long-term responses. And I would hope that response would occur regardless of whether Whangamorino was its own FMU or not.
You would hope that, wouldn't you? But yesterday you said when Ms. Tumai was asking you about the method that DOC is seeking for the Whangamorino, that there's a whole set of actions that's required, and it requires political will. So wouldn't a separate FMU provide an absolute focus on this wetland and galvanise action that includes catchment management planning, a number of different parties, to focus on that particular wetland concept?
This might be straying into planning, but the I'm just wondering to what extent the the requirements of anything you would deliver on.
Right.
Something quite different.
That's fair. It's possibly delving into planning, so I'll leave that for Mr. Trebalco. Now, the FMUs for lakes, one issue is that the mapping of the FMUs for lakes in map 3.11.1, and I'm referring here to the plan change 1 version attached to the legal submissions of Flint and Grierson. Currently the mapping is inadequate for a farmer to ascertain whether they are in a lake catchment.
Yes, I think, and that was, we covered that in technical caucus, and I think even some of the experts found it difficult to identify the catchment boundaries that were in that map. I think there was general agreement that a more detailed spatial layer, a more detailed GIS information package could be provided that would be more helpful.
Yes, and that's at the JWS Lakes at 11. Matter of agreement 4, it is important to include the surrounding catchments for lake FMUs in figure 3.11.1 is not currently sufficient, and a more detailed GIS shape file should be provided by the council. Has that been provided, or will it be provided during the hearing process?
I'm uncertain of the process there, so the technical experts have said that they think that would be useful, but I haven't taken that any further.
Right, so the lake FMUs don't sit geographically with any mapping of the sub-catchment or the tributaries, as far as I can see.
Every lake catchment, as identified in that 3.11.1, sits with its catchment outlined. Mm. Those lakes sit within broader catchments.
Mm.
So, in almost all cases, those lakes will flow into river FMUs.
Mm.
So they're part of the river FMUs, part of sub-catchments, but they form their own specific FMUs with their associated catchments.
But that relationship you're talking about is not able to be ascertained at all from this plan change on its face, is it?
The information is there in figure 3.11.1, but what the technical experts considered was that map is too coarse, for individual landowners to be able to zoom in and ascertain where they sit in relation to those lakes.
Right. So, in your evidence in chief, you talk about what we call heat maps, which were where you tried to identify within certain sub-catchments what was the primary nutrient of concern, E. coli, sediment, nitrogen or phosphorus.
Yes.
And that was incorporated in Table 3.11.2, which set out the different subcatchments and the primary nutrients of concern for those subcatchments. Yes?
Yes. So the technical leaders group provided information to the collaborative stakeholder group on those heat maps. Obviously, the decisions version of those, of Table 311.2, the Commission has changed, made a number of changes to the original table.
The Commission has altered those heat maps and the Table 311.2 based on what mapping that you had done, and those that Table 311.2 is now being withdrawn on your recommendation because it didn't take into account what was required in nutrient sensitive downstream water bodies, wetlands and lakes?
So from a technical perspective, there's a general recognition that all four contaminants need to be managed, and that the intent of that table to help assist landowners with identifying where their prioritisation of effort should go, that's to a large extent been superseded by those CCCV documents, if you like. So there's a recognition that landowners need some guidance as to the things they should be focusing their efforts on. And as I say, I think we've reached a point, in my view, that Table 311.2 is no longer needed to do that.
With the benefit of hindsight, had you placed lakes within better in terms of mapping within a catchment and sub-catchment context on the face of this plan, you might have recognised the need to consider the lakes when you did the heat mapping?
Yes, because the lakes sit within wider catchments, one option, and I'm pretty sure it was an option put to CSG, was that the lakes would simply be considered as part of the four river FMUs, as opposed to separate. But there was a decision made at that time that the lakes would be separate FMUs and might be managed separately.
I'll ask Mr. Trebelko questions around the benefit of creating lake-by-lake FMUs as distinct from the four FMUs that were chosen by the CSG. But a technical question that unpops into this is your understanding that for an FMU, you require a monitoring point for every FMU. That's your understanding, isn't it?
So, yeah, the requirement is, in my understanding, that every FMU should have a representative monitoring network associated with it.
And is your reading of the NPSFM, and again, forgive me if I'm straying into planning here, that for FMUs you can rely on modelled information for monitoring. You don't need a physical monitoring point in every FMU.
Yep, that's reasonable, yes.
And the Regional Council has a probabilistic monitoring framework.
Yes.
And it's spatially, it's designed using a spatially balanced probability of sample of represented sites, which has resulted in a near even spread of monitored lakes across the Waikato region relative to their distribution in the landscape. Yes?
Yes.
And the statistical properties of the network design allow for unbiased estimates of resource condition, i.e. state and water quality, and extent for all lakes without having to monitor every single lake in the region?
Yes.
And so the implementation of that network commenced in 2019 and sampling of the 38th lake began in 2021?
My understanding is that might have been 2018. that started. But yes, so we had a smaller number of long-term monitored lakes, and in recognition of the fact that PC1 had identified a gap in the extent to which we had knowledge of our lakes, that 38 lake monitoring program was established.
Thank you. So there's no barrier from a monitoring perspective to have FNUs for individual lake?
Yes, from a technical perspective, you could say that if you have 59 separate FMUs for lakes, then you could use that probabilistic network to provide an estimate of current state. Yes.
Thank you. I just have one more question. Thank you. And it's on Koi Kar.
Yes.
So, Koi Kar is an exacerbating function in the environment, as we've heard in answers to questions from Mr. Matheson. It exacerbates sediment once sediment is discharged into the river and stream network. Yes,
and obviously through actions of undercutting banks and bank erosion as well.
And as part of the existing environment, are you aware of any methods currently available able to reduce koi carp populations within the catchments?
Yes. So Waikato Regional Council undertook research into koi carp removal. It involved trapping of koi carp at a natural choke point and then composting those koi carp in a biodigester to produce fertiliser that was then used for restoration planting. So it was called the Carp in Neutral program. It was, I think, a really innovative and actually won a Ministry for the Environment Environmental Award. When the pilot came to an end, though, the infrastructure, we looked at identifying a commercial partner who could take that technology and expand on it, and we were unable to find a partner for that. So it's only ever been a pilot.
Does that reduce population levels, or does it indeed have any effect on koi carp population levels?
My understanding that the work done around the feasibility of it would require multiple catching points, so multiple devices to trap koi carp, and it would only result in a reduction in populations. There was some analysis done to suggest that we might be able to reduce the population to a level where we would see some significant benefits associated with it. The other benefit, and this is conversations that we had with some potential partners, was around every koi carp removed from, and in this case it was Lake Waikato, every koi carp is a parcel of nitrogen, phosphorus, and obviously a whole lot of other things. So if we could trap large numbers of koi, turn them into fertiliser and export that fertiliser, where it's essentially exporting nutrients from the catchment, which would have beneficial effects in terms of the levels of eutrophication in the lake itself, direct benefits.
So just finally, does the Regional Council have the resource zone, because I understand it's very expensive to undertake that over the whole of the PC1 catchment?
No, we don't have that resource.
Thank you. Those are all my questions.
Thank you, Ms. Onley. Just before we take the break, I'm just Cook, just following up on that, I think I heard you say that the scope of the project was to reduce numbers. Eradication is not considered to be feasible?
No, not feasible at all.
Because they're all over?
And they're such prolific breeders as
yeah.
well.
All right, we'll take the morning adjournment now until about 4:15, and then I think following Fish and Game Horticulture New Zealand.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.